they are substantially different in that they leave it inside the department.
The House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development come to order. It's April 7th, Tuesday. We have a full hearing and a full agenda, and we'll do our best to get through it. We'll start by opening a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 37. Barbara, if you could give us a summary, please.
H.J.R. 37 designates the Dungeness crab as the official crustacean of Oregon.
Nice. Thank you. Representative Bruhn and Representative Cowan, please.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us. Chair Reed and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jean Cowan, and I represent House District 10, which just might be the Central Oregon coast, home of the Dungeness crab industry.
Sure.
I do really appreciate you affording the time to hear this bill, House Joint Resolution 37. I got to get the number straight here. It's a bill that's long overdue. Those of us who live in Oregon understand the product that we're talking about here. The Dungeness crab is also an economic driver of our coastal communities. And I think that's important to remember for this committee. This is not just something that is fun. But what's really impressive to me is that the children who are about to testify before you today took this upon themselves. They understand the importance of this particular creature and to our economy, and besides that, it tastes good. And we know better than to stand in the way of children. And so I am going to close with that and will be standing by if anyone has any specific questions at the end of today's testimony.
Right. Thank you, Representative Cowan.
Mr. Chair, committee, I'm Scott Bruhn. I represent House District 37. And it's my honor to be up here. It's my honor and also my gratitude to Representative Cowan for co-sponsoring this bill with me. I have very limited testimony because the testimony is going to be taken care of by an elite crew of crab promoters. Let me just say very quickly that there's an ecological, an economic, and I think an aesthetic value to doing this bill. I mean, you'll hear about the ecological and the economic value. I hope you understand the aesthetic value as well. There's just something very cool about saying the state crustacean. Just to give you a little bit of background on this bill came about because of a school project at Sunset Primary School in West Lynn. The children in Ms. Busby's fourth grade class were journaling on different states, and long story short, it turns out that there's a couple other states that have an official state crustacean. Oregon was not one of them, so you can do the math from there. We determined that it was the wise thing for Oregon to do to have a state crustacean, and this class and their teachers took this upon themselves. They've done a boatload of research. They've prepared their testimony. They've learned all about the legislative process, and so without further ado, we're going to bring them up two by two to give you their convincing testimony.
Fantastic. And if you'd like to call them up, Representative Bruhn, that'd be great.
Yeah. And make sure you enter here. Come on. And start. Make sure you start by introducing yourself.
Hello. My name is Hannah Archuleta. I am a fourth grader at Sunset Primary School in West Lynn. We think the Dungeness crab should be Oregon's crustacean. There are many great reasons why I think that our state needs a crustacean. One of those reasons is that Oregon is known for its sea life and beaches. Oregon's coast is a very important part of the state. This is why I think we should have an official state crustacean. Did you know two states already have them? They are Louisiana and Maryland. The Dungeness crab is found off the coast from Alaska to Santa Cruz, California. Many tourists and people who live in Oregon enjoy crabbing for Dungeness crabs here off the Pacific coast. Passing a bill so that Oregon would have a state crustacean would tell everyone how important our beaches are. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Archuleta.
Hello, I am Zoe Craig. I am a fourth grader from Sunset Primary School in West Lynn. The Dungeness crab is a sustainable food source. It is sustainable because there are laws and restrictions on the type of crab you can catch and eat. For instance, if you catch a female crab, you have to put it back. The male has to be 5 inches measured on its back and not counting its legs. Also, there is a crabbing season for Oregon. It is starting December 1st to August 14th. You cannot fish for Dungeness crab during the breeding season because you need males and females during the breeding season. If people follow these laws, then we won't run out of Dungeness crab, and that is what makes it a sustainable industry. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Hannah and Zoe, right, for being here. I just wanted to ask you, before we get started, you've got something, both of you have something on your, you might want to, what is that?
I don't know.
Oh, it's a pin. Sorry. Have you, either one of you been to the beach?
Yes.
And have you actually seen one of these critters?
I have never, but I've learned a lot about it.
How about you, Hannah?
I have learned lots.
But have you seen? Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Follow up,
Mr. Chair.
Follow up, please.
You know, I can't just keep asking you questions. I have to ask him. It's very painful.
Have I ever stopped you?
No, to your credit.
It's always I have.
Yeah.
Always testing.
But have you seen one, Hannah?
No.
Yeah.
Please.
If you did, now that you've studied him, you think you'd know?
Probably.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
How would you pick him up if you saw him?
I probably wouldn't.
You have been studying. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Adina Molesky. I'm a fourth grader at Sunset Primary School in Westland. I'm going to tell you how the Dungeness crab is eco-friendly. Dungeness crab is a native species to the Pacific Ocean near the shore. It is one of the best crustaceans for the environment. The Environmental Defense Fund gave the Dungeness crab a thumbs up for being good for the environment and using the sustainable fishing practices. Dungeness crabs are not imported like most of the king crab, which are imported from Russia, where fishing regulations are poorly enforced, which leads to an unsustainable food line. Dungeness crabs are caught with traps, a method considered eco-friendly because fishermen can release undersized crabs and others that were accidentally caught. With all the attention on the Dungeness crab, more schools would want to teach their students about it, and it's very interesting. I hope you understand why we want the Dungeness crab to be the crustacean of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Muskie.
Hi, I'm Lucas Pichetto from Sunset Primary School in West Lynn. The Dungeness crab is the most commercially important crab in the Pacific Northwest and is very nutritious. Dungeness crab is a great source of protein and calcium and is low in calories, fat, and cholesterol. Dungeness crab does not have any mercury or PCBs like other seafood, which as you know can cause birth defects and cancer. The Dungeness crab is also delicious. It can be served in many ways, but my personal favorite is right over the shell with butter. I hope I convince you to vote yes on our Dungeness crab for our state crustacean. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Adina?
Mm-hmm.
Adina, if I understand from Zoe's testimony, the female crab is, if caught, is released back. What happens to the male crab?
I'm not sure.
Is it perhaps eaten?
We know how Luca wants to
eat. Yeah, actually, that was my next question, okay. Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair. Luca, and by the way, I have a feeling that might be an Italian surname, so
yep.
Molto bene.
You have something in common, it seems.
Yeah, so if the female crab is released back into the water as unharmed, but the male crab could be eaten,
yeah.
Are you okay with that?
Personally, I love my
So you're okay with the follow-up?
Please.
You're okay that the
yeah.
male crabs eat, that's not a problem for you?
Yeah, but they put the female back, so we will always have more.
Good point. One more?
Please.
This is for either of you. How do you think the other crustaceans will feel if we single out the crab for the state crustacean? Are you concerned about that?
Maybe they're friends.
Thank you very much.
That's a good answer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that might have, when he called him Mr. Chair, it might have been fortuitous.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Might be foretelling, too.
Or foretelling.
I'm Josiah McCourt, and I am a fourth grader at Sunset Primary School in Westland. I really believe that making the Dungeness Crab Oregon State Coast Station would help Oregon. Crabbing along the Oregon coast creates jobs for fishermen, the people who sell the crabs to restaurants, and other food manufacturers. This leads to employment in the whole state for people who use and cook the crab. Most Oregon coastal seafood processors purchase and process Dungeness crab, so then the people can buy them. So fishermen will sell more, and they'll get more money, and the economy will go up. Plus, the Dungeness crab fishery in Oregon is the most valuable single-species fishery in Oregon, so the Dungeness crab is pretty valuable for Oregon. So that is why I think the Dungeness crab should be the official state crustacean of Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Hi. My name is Natalie Barone. I am a fourth grader at Sunset Primary School in Westland. I hope we convince you that the Dungeness crab should be named the state crustacean of Oregon. We've shown you how naming the Dungeness crab the official state crustacean could help the Oregon economy. It would bring more attention to this delicious shellfish and help the crab fishermen in our state sell more crabs and make more money. We've also shown you that the Dungeness crab is a very healthy and tasty food source. Zoe explained that the Dungeness crab is a very sustainable food source, and Adina told you how the Dungeness crab industry is eco-friendly. Thank you for listening to our testimony on the Dungeness crab. I hope you now see that making the Dungeness crab the official state crustacean will be good for Oregon. Please vote yes for HJR 37. As the Oregonian newspaper says, nothing says Oregon like the Dungeness crab.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Natalie, is it Bruin? What is that?
Bruin.
Thank you. Natalie, I think it's important that we all know just a little bit about those that are testifying. What district are you from, Natalie?
District 37.
37. Okay. Natalie, would you consider yourself satisfied with the representation you're receiving?
She's having to think about it. Just on Saturdays.
Just how do you feel about your state representative is the question.
I feel good about it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, to answer.
Just for the record.
Dangerous question to ask her.
So do we. Now, Natalie, I couldn't help but notice it's a good tack to take when you're testifying. You quoted, or you used a quote from the Oregonian newspaper. And my question to you is, around your house, has anybody ever complained about the Oregonian newspaper?
Only when it doesn't come.
Mr. Chair, I fear I'm out of my depth.
I was going to say, are you sure you want to continue with this language?
Thank you, Natalie.
Thank you very much. I had one question. I noticed in the testimony earlier, I sort of missed it, I think. Louisiana and Maryland also have state crustaceans, too, I understand now. What are their state crustaceans?
Louisiana is the crawfish, and Maryland is the blue crab.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Holby.
I was wondering, I've been looking at this bill for a long time, I was wondering if any of you can tell me what the benefit to the crab is in this bill.
Lily's been telling you.
And another thing, don't you think there ought to be a special day for the crab if he is the state crab or she is the state crab?
That's actually a very good idea.
It might be a bill project for next school year.
Might be.
Maybe do you want to work on that for next session, maybe? That can be your next project, perhaps.
Think about a crabby day.
Sometimes we have those here frequently, don't we? Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. You guys were very articulate, well organized, and have been persuasive. We have three other people who have signed up to testify: Terry Thompson, Joe Rolizer. I hope I'm getting that close. To, a little hard to read the handwriting. And Nick Furman.
Yeah, really. I'm going to make mine brief because I can't possibly match the testimony or the answers or the skills of the people that are here. But
Mr. Commissioner, okay, you know to start with.
My name is Terry Thompson, Lincoln County Commissioner.
Thank you.
But I will invite any of the kids. I am an avid sports crabber and commercial crabber. I own a 68-foot vessel. Any of the kids that testified, I'd like them to write down the number 265-4100. That's my office number. And if you come to the coast after August, I'll take you crabbing. And I don't do that very often for very many people, but I'm so impressed by what you brought forward. Simply, I thought their testimony was fabulous, and I am not going to add anything to it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I live in Walport, and I represent a diverse group of commercial and sports fishermen. In this case, and in this case only, I tend to agree with ex-representative Thompson. I represent mostly sports fishermen, and he represents mostly commercial fishermen. I've been crabbing with him. And so I support this bill, and thank you very much for bringing it forward.
Thank you.
I now know how Art Linkletter felt. And I'm still trying to figure out how those kids got the advanced copy of my testimony. They just about covered everything that I'm going to share. For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Nick Furman. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission. And if you'll bear with me, I'd like to read from some prepared comments. As an industry-funded organization under the umbrella of the Oregon Department of Agriculture's Commodity Commission Program, the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission represents the 433 limited-entry crab permit holders who harvest dungeness along the state's 300 miles of coastline. On behalf of those fishermen, their crews, and their families, we are honored that Natalie Brune and her classmates at Sunset Primary School in West Lynn have proposed that dungeness crab be designated the official state crustacean. It's appropriate that HJR 37's first public hearing is before your committee today, as the dungeness crab and the fishery it supports are both sustainable and a proven economic driver within Oregon's coastal communities and beyond. Thanks to sound management by the Department of Fish and Wildlife and minimal impact harvest methods, the fishery has earned the endorsement of all the major environmental conservation groups for its sustainability and is close to achieving Marine Stewardship Council certification, the recognized international standard for sustainable fisheries around the globe. The Dungeness crab fishery has grown to become the most valuable single-species fishery in the state. During the past 10 years, Dungeness crab landings have represented between 25 and 52% of the annual landed value of all the commercially harvested fish and shellfish in Oregon. In the 2004-2005 season, Oregon crabbers set the all-time landing record of 33.7 million pounds for the entire range of the Dungeness fishery, that's Central California to the Gulf of Alaska, and in the entire 150-year history of that fishery. Since the present season began 4 short months ago in December, fishermen on the Oregon coast have landed 12.3 million pounds of crab with an ex-vessel or to-the-boat value of $26.6 million. Apply a conservative multiplier of 2 to capture the related economic activity, and those crab landings translate into $53.2 million in port communities from Astoria to Brookings. Thanks to favorable ocean conditions and healthy stocks, Oregon is currently the number one producer of Dungeness crab in the world. Not only is it that bounty enjoyed in our own state, but we're happy to report that Oregon Dungeness is now sold, served, and enjoyed nationwide, and wherever people appreciate high-quality gourmet shellfish. In mainland China and Hong Kong, thanks in part to the work of the Department of Agriculture, our biggest export markets, the characters for Dungeness crab translate into very valuable crab. We think there's a compliment in there somewhere. In the midst of a difficult legislative session, we appreciate the time you and your fellow legislators are giving to this seemingly small resolution to elevate Dungeness crab to the lofty status as the state's official crustacean. While it will only occupy one short notation in the Oregon Blue Book of State Facts and Statistics, it will go a long way in solidifying the iconic stature deserving of the shellfish Oregon's native son James Beard spoke of when he said Dungeness crab was a meal the gods intended only for the pure in palate. And with that, we again thank Natalie and her classmates for their efforts.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Representative Thatcher?
I'm just curious, and this is directed at you, Mr. Furman. Any of you can answer, but I've always heard that you're supposed to get crab during an R month. Have you heard that? And is there any basis to that?
Terry, you want to take that? I know you're straight. I can see you.
Ready to jump.
Actually, Dungeness crab in the ocean ends in August. It isn't having to do with an R month. But we sport crab throughout the year. There's a skip molt crab that lives in some of the bays. And it's been a different process here than most other states. And it's made the sport crab fishery very, very profitable in the fall. So we harvest them all year round. Mm-hmm. But they are, after they molt, is usually after July. So that would be end of the R month. So
okay.
The commercials where there's a time period there.
Yeah, so I was reading the thing.
And it starts the first of December. That's the big month. So remember when Representative Thompson says he's going to take these kids out in August, we want to make sure it's before August 15th because that's when the season's closed.
Well, let's make it clear. I'm not taking them out in the ocean commercial fishing. I'd be glad to give them a tour of a crab boat, and I'm sure I could find 100 fishermen who'd be delighted to give that tour, but right. Sport crabbing in the bay is just a ball for kids and parents too. It's a great thing for families to do, and the Walport Bay that Joe lives in is probably one of the best fisheries there is, and if their parents have the time and they use that number, that 265-4100, it's 541 number, and contact me, I'll set up a way for them to actually go handle the crab and get them over that fear.
It'll be interesting to see, Mr. Commissioner, how many calls you get from people who've been listening.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you very much.
That completes the list of folks who had signed up to testify. Is there anyone else who needs to be heard on this joint resolution? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 37 and open a work session on House Joint Resolution 37. Representative Galizio?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move House Joint Resolution 37 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you very much. Representative Galizio moves House Joint Resolution 37 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Galizio?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, when I first saw this bill, I was a little bit skeptical. And then I was worried about how the other crustaceans would feel. But I think Luca, my paisano, did a great job, and as did all of the people testifying except for the last three, did a great job, just kidding. And they convinced me that this is the right thing to do, so I wanted to thank them again, and I'm in full support of this.
Thank you. Representative Cowan?
Mr. Chair, I just have some information to add after you successfully complete your work session.
I appreciate your optimism. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that I hope that the folks in the audience here who regularly come forward and testify on bills have taken notes on the quality testimony that has been delivered by these students here. Clear and articulate and precise answers to questions, so I hope that won't go unnoticed.
And concise.
And concise. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for adding that.
The only thing I would add, although Representative Holby, you had your hand up.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, I was just hoping that someday I hope that, and there might already be one, as some sort of crab festival to really, celebrate the accomplishments of the crab.
We'll take that into consideration.
There are a number of jokes that might be made there, but I'll let it go. I just wanted to add my thanks for you all coming and being part of the legislative process. I hope you, when you go back to your school and when you're talking to your friends and neighbors who aren't part of your class, that you'll tell them about your experience. Hopefully it's a good one and encourage more people to be involved in the legislative process. So I appreciate you being here.
Mr. Chair, can I
please
a quick follow-up point to that? I
appreciate
that. Time we have it. Representative Gilliam wants to move on, but I'll go ahead.
I just want to make sure, in that vein, I want to do a public thank you to the teachers and the principal at Sunset High School. It's Ms. Busby, Ms. Pasika, and Ms. Ludwig, the two fourth-grade teachers and the principal, respectively, who have absolutely taken this is not part of their original school curriculum. This is a couple of people with an idea, and the idea grew to the classroom, and they have taken this on with such a just a magnificent positivism and made this such a great project for the school-wide. I just want to put in they're watching right now. Hope everybody waves back
you.
There. Just how much I personally appreciate the teachers and the principal taking this on. It's just a real tribute to public education.
Thank you, Representative Brown. Very well. The motion on the floor then is to send House Joint Resolution 37 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. If there isn't further discussion, could you please call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Holvey?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
Aye.
Vice Chair Galizio?
Aye.
Chair Reed?
Aye.
The motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed. House Joint Resolution 37 goes to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Representative Bruin, Representative Cowan, would I understand you would be willing to be co-carriers on the floor?
We'd be delighted.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Please.
Just to let you know that we had a suspicion that this bill might pass, and so we've done a little bit of advanced work. It will come to the floor on April 20th, and that will be quite a fine day in the Capitol with the contributions of the Dungeness Crab Commission. I think that you will enjoy yourselves in the Galleria as well, and we will look forward to seeing these folks and their classmates back on April 20th. Sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Galizio?
Yeah, and would it be okay if any emails that we receive saying, why are you doing a bill like this when the budget is falling apart, we can forward them to the two of you?
This economic development, we are proud.
There are jobs that will be created.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm now hungry.
we'll keep that in mind if you disappear at some point during the hearing. With that, close the work session on House Joint Resolution 37 and open a work session on House Bill 2598. Barbara, if you could bring us back up to speed. Thank you again for coming. Appreciate it.
HB 2598 establishes a 13-member human cell research committee in the Department of Human Services, requires the governor to appoint the committee and delineates its representation, term length, and other administrative rules, authorizes the committee to seek private and public contributions for the purpose of funding research grants from the fund, and many other points of the bill, declares an emergency and makes the act effective July 1, 2009.
Thank you very much. Committee, you'll remember we had a lengthy and robust discussion about the contents of this bill some weeks ago. It's back before us with some amendments, many of which you have in your packet, and it probably makes sense to start with the Dash 6 amendments that have might best be associated with Representative Galizio, if you're willing to help us understand those. And I think we have some folks who can help update us on the process that has resulted in these amendments and on recent developments generally, too. Representative Galizio?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, colleagues, just wanted to go through the Dash 6 amendments. They do four things. First, they reduce the number of people on the Stem Cell Research Committee from 13 down to 9. The amendment does not, however, reduce the number of committee members from the general public. That remains. Second, it changes the duties of the research committee. As I know most of you are probably aware, there's been a lot of work on developing stem cell research guidelines being done at the federal level. So that is going to be useful to that committee. The National Institutes of Health has begun developing guidelines and working with some of the best and brightest scientific minds in the country. So, their work's building on National Academies of Science work in terms of putting forward guidelines. And so that is going to be useful to the committee. We don't want to duplicate efforts or good work that's being done at the federal level. However, at the same time, understanding that as a state legislature representing Oregonians, we want to put an Oregon imprimatur on our work. So we're trying to achieve that delicate balance, which is paying close attention to and in many cases following the federal guidelines, at the same time wanting to make certain that we're doing our due diligence here, yet not wanting to make Oregon less attractive to researchers, students, and to hinder any possibility of obtaining private or public monies. So third, the amendments make some changes to the section relating to human cloning. human cloning is not simple to define. So in doing some research, and we have Susan Bankowski here from Oregon Health and Sciences University, the Institutional Review Board, who's going to be available. OHSU and other institutions, instead of defining human cloning, they instead essentially describe practices that are prohibited. So that's what another element of the Dash 6 Amendment. And finally, these amendments lay out the standards that the research institution must abide by in order to receive grant money under the bill. So you can only receive grant money, institutions that abide by NIH or National Institutes of Health guidelines, or which have been adopted by the committee itself, and which we think is an important ethical safeguard. So in sum, I think this set of amendments, or this amendment, does a good job of respecting the idea of free scientific inquiry, and at the same time ensuring that scientists in our state abide by what we think are reasonable ethical guidelines. And then finally, Mr. Chair, I wanted to alert the committee to a drafting error on the back page. Let's see. Yeah, on page 6 of the Dash 6 in section 13, so the very back page. Through great work of Patty O'Sullivan, who's here from Department of Health, Department of Human Services, we managed to reduce the fiscal, and she's here today and can talk a little bit about that. So it says $159,000. That is no longer applicable to this bill. We've reduced the cost by about $50,000 through some great work, which is going to maintain the integrity of the process, yet reducing the number of people on the committee, etc. So I understand this will have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and it'll be dealt with down there, but I just wanted to let everyone on the committee know that the price tag on this has been reduced by about $50,000, and again, DHS is here to talk about that if need be.
Thank you very much. Perhaps we should invite Mrs. Sullivan and Ms. Bankowski up to give us a little bit of an update on how this process came about, and I know there have been some developments in the larger world on this topic since last we discussed it, so that might also be worthwhile to hear about. Please.
For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Government Relations for the Department of Human Services. This bill comes to you. There was a bill, similar bill last session, which we had priced, and coincidentally, that price was $159,336. So that's where piece of information came from last session. When we got the bill this session, of course the price tag went up because of inflation and other things like that. And through the patience of Representative Galizio and his staff, I worked with them on some amendments that could get the fiscal impact down. Some of those amendments are the starting dates of the committee, so that the staff would not have to be brought on right away, and the fact that there's some federal guidelines that are now coming down reduced the type of staff we needed. We thought we needed a physician. We've now reduced that to an OP4, which is a very high-level analyst. Sometimes on these committees, you have it really depends on the committee, the type of information that will be coming to the committee, if there are other people in the department that do similar work that can guide the person running the committee. In this case, stem cell research is not something that we've been involved in before. This committee and its staffing would be in the public health division, and we felt like we needed a high-level staff to be able to understand the subject matter that the committee was talking about. So the fiscal is a little higher than normal just to staff a committee, but we really needed to wrap the committee around some other folks that can help. So two positions, which are the high-level OPA 4 and the clerical position, are half-time for 12 months and 7 months, 12 months for the OPA 4 to start it out, and 7 months for the clerical person to come in and start helping guide the work of the committee. And then we have another position that wouldn't be funded until the 11-13 biennia, because the way that the bill reads is that the committee will go out and look for funding in order to be able to give grants out. That grant work would not start until the second biennia, because there would be no money to grant to anybody. So that position starts in the second biennia. So to make a longer story a little shorter, at this point, the fiscal impact is $109,771 for the 09-11 biennia, and that would need to be funded in ways and means. It's not currently in our budget. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you very much.
I hope I did. I lived up to the former witnesses.
They're tough standards.
I know nothing about things that grow in the ocean, though, so don't.
Pass through here from Ms. Bankowski first and then take questions.
Hello, my name is Susan Bankowski. I am the chairperson of the Institutional Review Boards, which are the ethical review committees at OHSU, and I'm also the regulatory specialist staffing the Stem Cell Research Oversight Committee at OHSU. I'm here solely for questioning. I can answer any questions that you have. I will say that we've been, since the only developments that we've had since the last meeting is that our Stem Cell Committee continues to meet and help advise me on these matters, and so any advice that I've brought forward has been, and information I've brought forward has been informed by the Stem Cell Scientists at OHSU.
Thank you very much. Other questions?
A quick question.
You were, I'm sure if you're pointing there, Representative Gilliam, get one hand, a finger out.
I know.
Like you're pointing down here. Representative Gilliam, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Vice Chair Galizio may be the one to ask this, but I wanted to ask this while you're up here. Are you aware of any of any federal programs that you're sort of positioning for that require a contribution from the state of Oregon in order to get the grant or to be eligible?
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. I'm unaware currently if there's any sort of matching program that's been developed yet, if that's what you're referring to.
Yeah. Thanks.
Other questions? Seeing none. Representative Glizio.
Mr. Chair, I move the -6 amendment on House Bill 20. I move the adoption of the -6 amendment on House Bill 2598.
Thank you. Representative Galizio moves the adoption of the -6 amendments dated April 6, 2009 to House Bill 2598. Are there comments? Is there discussion? Representative Benson?
Mr. Chair, probably a question for Representative Galizio on Section 2
of the amendment.
Of the amendment.
Okay.
Hang on.
-6.
Am I reading the portion there on lines 24 through 30 correctly and understanding it to say that the research must be in accordance with the federal regulations, requirements, and guidelines for the conduct of the stem cell research? Perhaps you could, can you tell me how far the committee could vary from the federal regulations, if at all, under that language?
Vice Chair Benz, I would preface any of my comments with saying, unlike yourself, and I'm not disparaging, I'm not an attorney, and Ms. Bankowski could probably speak to this well. The idea, I could give you the concept more than parse the language and tell you the impact. The idea is that you're looking at, you want to align with the federal guidelines and not prohibit scientists in the state of Oregon from having a competitive disadvantage and creating more barriers or obstacles. So the goal is to align with the federal guidelines, and I think I'll just stop there before I say something that an attorney would advise me is incorrect.
Thank you. Representative Benz, there are guidelines that exist, and as you know, they're only guidelines. There will likely be requirements for receipt of funding from NIH, so those would in fact be requirements if you were going to receive NIH dollars. And then there are there is a federal regulation banning the creation of embryos for research purposes. And so those are kind of piecemeal guidelines, regulations, and requirements that exist currently for the conduct of embryonic stem cell research. And so, as I understand this, this is an attempt to bring those all together and require the highest standards for the conduct of embryonic stem cell research in Oregon, regardless of funding source.
Follow those, Chair. I'm just, and I do appreciate the effort that's been made in this amendment. I think it's vastly advanced from that which we were looking at earlier, and in many positive ways. But I just want to understand the nature of that balance, and it appears to me from my review of this language on lines 24 to 30 that in order to assure that Oregon receives the funding or to increase the chances of Oregon receiving positive outcome of its grant applications, it appears that we have drawn this so that our guidelines must, and I'm using that word advisedly on purpose, square with the federal guidelines, and that if we were to not be consistent, then we wouldn't be following the language in 24 through 30. If the group charged with the obligation of creating the guidelines chose to move away from that which the federal folks have suggested we should follow, we would be outside the scope of this language.
Yes, that is correct.
Other questions? Seeing none, the motion is to adopt the Dash 6 amendments, House Bill 2598. Would you please call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
No.
Vice Chair Felicio?
Aye.
Chair Reed?
Aye. Motion having received the required majority is declared passed. The Dash 6 amendments are adopted. We have not received, thank you very much for your testimony, we have not received the fiscal and revenue statement, so we are not prepared to move the bill further at this time, but appreciate the further discussion. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2598. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3037. Barbara, please give us a...
HB 3037 creates a paint stewardship pilot program for the purpose of reducing the generation of post-consumer paint, promoting the reuse of post-consumer paint, and developing a process of collecting, transporting, and processing the paint to an environmentally sound fashion. Requires the creation of a nonprofit representative organization by paint manufacturers to develop a plan to implement the program, including a funding mechanism and the development of educational materials for consumers. Delineates the reporting process. Sunsets January 2nd, 2014.
Thank you very much. This is the bill, I believe, that Representative Witt brought to us. So appreciate you doing that again. We get a chance to hear a little bit more about it. We have two people who have signed up, and I think one other person who probably has something to say. So I see Ted Hughes, Scott, I see a K, an L, and a Y, or a G. I'm not sure what the G, okay, cool. And Palmer Mason. So whichever order you guys would like to go and help understand, help us understand the bill would be great.
I'll come up with my newest and best friend, the DEQ.
Fabulous. We'd love to hear that.
I don't hear that often enough.
No, I like hearing that. That's very great.
And I'd like to have you delay for a moment. I have my granddaughters coming over to make my testimony.
Oh, very good. Well, we'll start with these guys. And Are they gonna add in as well? That's good.
Why don't you go back?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here to testify on House Bill 3037. The department has been working with the paint industry on the concept behind this bill. I say the concept behind this bill because the bill language is still a work in progress, but to their credit, the paint industry approached the department about creating a voluntary program where the manufacturers would fund collection and recycling systems here in Oregon, so that if any of us who are in the middle of a paint project and we have leftover paint, we can take it to one of these collection sites and they will process the paint in an environmentally sound way, and either, depending on the paint, use it for energy recovery, or for some paints can be recycled and created into new paint. There are a few more issues that we have to work out with, but we've been working hand in glove with them. Some of those issues include setting up a plan approval and oversight process in the bill, dealing with the dates. There's also an issue of antitrust that we'll have to work through. And then finally, I think the issue that hung us up the most, but I think we are getting very close to working that out, is the issue of fees. The fees would be needed to cover the department's oversight costs because we have no general fund to pay for that, and I don't need to tell you how scarce general fund is this year, so we would need the fees to cover our costs. But I think we're very close to reaching an agreement with the paint industry, and so we hope to do that very shortly, and I can take any questions.
So just to understand before the others go, it sounds like then there are some additional amendments that are forthcoming?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
You want to go next?
Want me to go?
Go ahead.
Go.
You look like you're more ready now.
Sure. Right down here.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Scott Clagg. I'm with Metro Regional Government, testifying here in support of the concept of the paint stewardship bill. Metro, as you may know, is the regional government in the Portland metropolitan area, and we have extensive programs and responsibilities in solid waste management. One of the things we do is provide a large household hazardous waste program, which also collects quite a bit of paint when it does that from the residents in our region. A long time ago, we saw the value of working with industry on the development of the paint program. We participated from the inception in the national dialogue with the paint industry and retailers called the Paint Product Stewardship Initiative, coordinated by the Product Stewardship Institute out of Massachusetts. We participated since 2003 in that, and it managed to produce a couple memorandum of understanding. Participated in that process, hosted some meetings, contributed to a number of projects in terms of the problems that needed to be overcome before the paint industry was willing to work on a program like this with local governments. I'm proud to say that it helped us get certification for our paint as a good recycled paint, a green seal for that. Now, this bill really enables a project to come forward that was part of that national dialogue and initiative. It will enable a paint program to roll out in the state of Oregon, a pilot program. And this program really is very important to Metro and to local governments throughout the state. We do have a good paint program. We collect and recycle a lot of paint and are able to sell it. We even work with some retailers to sell some of that. So we're looking forward to continuing this partnership with industry. And as Palmer talked about, in these financial times, this could represent a significant reduction in our costs if the paint industry has the opportunity to have this program. So we urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hughes.
Well, I guess my granddaughters aren't here, so I'm it. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ted Hughes, representing today the Pacific Northwest Paint Council. The Paint Council is a regional association affiliated with the National Paint and Coatings Association. By the way, the bill that you have in front of you was strictly a placeholder bill while the Department of Environmental Quality and ourselves ironed out some differences, and we are, in fact, just about there. One of the principal differences was
a lot of the industry that I represent said, why are we paying DEQ fees? We're doing it all ourselves. We've gotten over that. There is DEQ does have oversight. They have responsibilities in the final bill that you'll see. And we will come forward with joint amendments at your next hearing. I'm sorry, today we should have had big shots from Washington, D.C. Instead, you got me. That were involved nationally on this program and could give you a better background than I. They will be here at the next hearing. The paint industry decided, by the way, and I'm very proud of them for doing it, to take the initiative and recover and recycle the products they manufacture. It was not an easy road to get here where we are today. Some of the industry people said, I don't want to undertake this. Most of the local government folks approved of our approach, but we, as I say, have agreed almost to the letter now, I believe. We'll know, by the way, Mr. Chairman, we'll know about this fee thing that I'm talking about, which is really our final hang-up on the thing, on the 26th of April. That's when the National Board meets to sign off on it, because the original concept was not fees to any government for oversight.
Did you set that date just the 2 days before our deadline here in the House, or is that
is that your deadline?
The 28th is the deadline
for getting the bill out
of the House committees. That's right.
So I think I might as well take credit for that. No, sir. we set that date because it's the National Paint and Coating Association's board meeting. They have to sign off on this final product. As I said, not everybody in the industry is ecstatic about undertaking it, but they're all willing to do it. And that's why I'm so proud of I passed you a summary of the program. I handed out a summary of the program. At your next meeting, we will have the big shots from D.C. and from Canada here. We know how to do this because we have been involved in a program in Canada on recovering the products for the last 3 years. And we intend to bring the Canadian people down and act as our consultants to put this program together correctly and make sure that there are no pitfalls. So that is a brief summary, together with what I handed out of the program. At your next meeting, we'd like to bring the Canadian person down so you can answer technical questions like just how does this work, things of that nature that I would stumble through and may not be right. So on the 26th would be great. I'm sure you don't have anything else on your agenda that day, since it's the final day.
We will work it out, I'm confident.
But basically, I want to congratulate DEQ and Metro and the stakeholder groups that have been working towards this end and have been very cooperative with us and tried to assist us to get where we're at today.
We appreciate your work, and I think are optimistic about seeing those amendments as they're forthcoming. Other questions, Representative Vince?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The stewardship discussions we've been having in other committees generally lead to questions about cost, and I am just curious if the manufacturers are willing to hazard a guess as to the additional cost that the consumer will pay as a result of this necessary recycling kind of circular program.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, we've spent a lot of time on that subject to some of our people's heartburns, but basically in Canada, which is our model here, it's been roughly about 40 cents increase in cost per, I don't know if it's a gallon or a unit, one or the other. It adds about additional 40 cents to the final product.
number of questions with that, right? Is it liters or gallons? Right. Canadian dollars, U.S. dollars? Who knows? That's helpful for the scale, though, I think.
Sure. But that was much debated on how much increased cost the industry's going to experience in that regard.
Was it discussed in a percentage basis, like it's going to increase the cost of this type of paint by 2%, 1%? Were there discussions, or are they waiting for the pilot project?
I don't think we ever got to discussing a percentage of the price. Not a bad idea. I wish you were at one of these stakeholder meetings and brought that up, Representative. But the folks that will come here on April 26th are the instant experts on this whole thing and be able to answer your question more realistically.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Thatcher?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if a program like this would be in conflict or in competition with programs that are run by nonprofits now, where they will take people's paint, remix it, and sell it back for a really reduced price, and that raises funds for their organization and gives the consumer something, you know, less expensive to redecorate their home with. So I just wondered about that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, Metro has a giant state-of-the-art recycling paint plant, and that's pretty much what they do today, if you could explain how that works.
Chair Reed, Representative Thatcher. I could address Representative Ben's question about cost a little bit. Part of this program and the desirability of it is that the industry will be working with the infrastructure that already exists. So Metro has, as Ted was saying, a large facility up on Swan Island where we process all the paint we collected and then we market it. I think for those programs that exist, I'm not personally aware of what parts of the state they're in. I do know that some parts of the state the local governments have had to discontinue some of their paint recycling efforts, and they would be helped. And I would expect that if there are these activities that are going on, it could work with this program. Because that's the intent, is to work with the existing infrastructure and maximize it. In terms of the cost, I think we're looking at some pretty good cost for the industry because Metro's been up and running for a number of years now. We have pretty efficient processes, and we'll be kind of offering, you know, in addition to what the Canadians can offer, we have our own expertise that we can help on this.
Just follow up?
Please.
I guess what I'm looking at is, I'm understanding that these nonprofits will do this themselves. It's outside of government. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some of them also will get them from Metro or some local other, you know, agency in government that recycles paint, makes it available for folks. But I'm just wondering if, I don't know, by introducing government, it's going to just make it cost more, and really we're not going to be doing any more than we already are as far as paint recycling.
Once more. Chair Reed, Representative Thatcher. I believe that I think some of the smaller programs wouldn't be affected by this. Part of the problem is that there's a lot of lower value paint. One of the issues that we have is that people like to buy our recycled paint that's in the white and some of the certain shades. So there's a lot of product that can kind of get creamed off, and to a certain degree we try and recycle it all as much as we can. At this point we're not getting 100%. And a lot of the oil paint, for example, has to go for fuel and that. But I would think that those programs could still have a place, but there is a lot of sort of down the lesser product that we try and recycle, and that's more costly. So hopefully we can strike a balance for those that are able to provide some resources for their communities, as well as getting a larger amount of paint, which is more difficult to process.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman,
please.
Representative Thatcher, again, Palmer Mason, DEQ. I think you raise a good issue, Representative. I don't think anyone can't say that there won't be cases where a nonprofit may not get some amount of paint, because now under this program, people will have other options. And where they may have previously taken their paint to nonprofit, they will have other options. But I think the quick answer is there's plenty of paint to go around. Every time DEQ works with a local government to hold a collection event, there's just tons of paint that comes in. It's the largest single amount of household hazardous waste that we collect in the state. So I think there's more than enough paint to go around to work with the manufacturers as well as work the nonprofits. But it would be true that someone might not go to a nonprofit now because they have another option. But I think overall it'll be enough paint to go around.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, one comment. Oregon has three major paint manufacturing plants. One in Eugene, Forest Paint, Miller Paint, and Rada Paint in the Portland area. Both Miller and Rada are here in the audience today. So don't be mean to me because they're kind of my bosses. Don't ask me anything I can't answer.
Well, I have a question I hope you can answer. Is there reason to suspect, I mean, I've heard the comments about how Oregon would be a real national leader if we're able to adopt this and get going. Are there, could any of you comment on how that might translate into additional economic development opportunities and benefit to the state as we can hopefully continue that tradition of being pioneering?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I hesitated to say that nationally they chose Oregon to do this pilot project primarily because Oregon has a national reputation as being very innovative. Beaches for the public, bottle bills, things of that nature. Oregon has led the way. So we recommended that we start here, and this will be the only program by the industry in the entire United States so that we can pilot it, do it exactly right here, and proceed in other states with the same format.
And Mr. Chair, to add to your question or comment about economic development, right now we don't have an extensive system to collect paint in this state. The local governments have very limited options. There's only a handful of permanent facilities in the state, and then other local governments do periodic events. What this program would do is put collection options all across Oregon, and those haven't been provided or built yet. So the industry would have to go and hire vendors to collect the paint and then manage it and then process it and recycle it. So you're creating a whole new market now by making the manufacturers of paints set up infrastructure that they're not providing as of yet. So it creates new business opportunities and new employment opportunities for Oregonians.
Thank you. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I applaud this program. Sounds like it would be successful and create some economic opportunity and solve an environmental problem. Questions for the DEQ are, so today it's paint. What products do you see out there in the future that would, I guess, be sort of conducive to this same idea? You know, I think of asphalt roofing, for example, or, you know, some other products that are problems that may really have a useful life if they're reprocessed.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a great question. There's another bill that's being debated, House Bill 3060, that identifies two more products, and then if passed by the legislature, would set up a process where DEQ would recommend to subsequent legislatures additional products. And we think there are a variety of consumer products out there where this product stewardship approach could apply. The two that are named in House Bill 3060 are mercury lighting, like the fluorescent tubes that are used here in this building, or compact fluorescent light bulbs, and the other is rechargeable batteries. Now, there is one thing that you have to say about rechargeable batteries, and you have to give a lot of credit to the rechargeable battery manufacturers. They are like the paint industry and have stepped forward and created their own national nonprofit, and they have a national infrastructure. So they've taken a huge step, like the paint industry has taken in terms of collecting and recycling these products. We were hoping to build on what they've done. Mercury lighting, on the other hand, is a product where we don't have a very good infrastructure at the household and small business level for people to take their discarded lamps. And I probably don't need to tell you this, but compact fluorescent light bulbs and fluorescent tubes have mercury, which is a powerful neurotoxin, and it's probably best that we don't see that added to the environment. And a collection and recycling program that would take these type of bulbs would be, I think, very good for Oregon.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Seeing none, thank you for being here. I missed the extra sheet when I was calling these three gentlemen up, and John Charles was on the other sheet. I apologize for missing you. I wasn't trying to
avoid you, but didn't see that sheet, so happy to hear from you, sir.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, and I have not been part of the stakeholder group that Mr. Hughes talked about. I didn't even know they existed, and my response here is just reading this as you might. And I'd like to suggest an alternative approach, actually. Generally, I'm a big fan of pilot projects because they usually involve someone opting into something and trying to find a creative way to learn, and then from the pilot process, you learn for something that's more permanent. In this case, there's a pretty big disconnect between the first 9 lines of the bill and the rest of the bill, because the first part talks about would allow paint manufacturers to, and then all the rest of the bill, you see about 10 uses of the word shall and must. So it's not really a pilot program in the traditional way, at least that I think of them. It's going to create a top-down sort of generic program with a bureaucracy, and the risk that runs is it drives the creativity out of the process because it's not really a pilot. People, the trade association comes together, you're going to do this, you know where this is headed, and it reminds me of what happened before you had the mandatory electronic take-back program you adopted 2 years ago. Prior to that, a number of vendors, Dell Computer, Home Depot, Office Max, were testing different programs of their own because they could see this as a way, if they could get you in their store and drop off some computers or televisions, that they would then have you there to sell you some things. And I thought that was a good way to go, but it was sort of cut off by the mandatory program. So it doesn't surprise me that there's a trade association involved here and that the word referenced by someone, the phrase antitrust implications, because what happens, I think, in an industry when they see the direction that's policy is headed is they want to sort of get ahead of the game, I think that's the phrase they would use. They come together and sort of create a business cartel working with DEQ. This sounds all very reasonable. As long as the advantage of the cartel approach is that as long as they're all in it together, none of them are disadvantaged. All the costs that might be borne are going to ultimately get shoved off on the consumer. So it's good for the industry, it's good for DEQ, it grows their agency. It's just not really good for people who actually have to pay, and they're not represented here directly, all the consumers. So my suggestion is to treat it as a real pilot project, and that is maybe put up a cash prize, say from the money you would save if you deleted Sections 3 and 4, which have some fiscal impact because DEQ bureaucracy grows, and let's just say the fiscal impact is $50,000, over a biennium. And let's just say the industry puts another $50,000 on the table and you offer up a $100,000 winner-take-all cash prize for the best take-back program that emerges over, say, a 3-year period, and you as maybe the Oregon Sustainability Board as the judges of this, and you encourage the 3 manufacturers in Oregon and all the ones elsewhere to come up with creative programs and just let the games begin. We have a lot of smart people sitting around in a room, many of whom know they actually can't win the prize because only one person is going to win, organization will win the prize, and therefore, once they go down this path, it actually has to be something that makes financial sense. And that's what we want to see, something that stands on its own feet as worth doing anyway, because that's what sustainable development is. And then $100,000 prize or some prize is always good, you know, good motivator anyway. Most of us do get motivated by that. And so you wouldn't even have to pay it out for 3 or 4 years, so it would have no fiscal impact on this budget. But I think if you were to create that approach of a cash prize and encourage many, many different pilots simultaneously, then you could learn from the best of that and go down that road as an alternative to this. So that's just a suggestion.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Did you have any reaction? I guess I appreciate your comments about the nature of being a pilot project and was looking at line 45 on page 2, which says that sections 1 and 4 are repealed. So it seems to me that would make it a pilot project in some significant ways.
Mr. Chairman, I did see that. My general thought is if you have a trade association coming together with DQ and the legislature to do this, and you start going down this path of fees and reporting, yes, this section is repealed, but ultimately this would end up, I envision, being just like the electronic take-back program. It would be the one program mandated by this would become the definitive program without ever really experimenting with other ways that independent folks might pursue if you structured it differently.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions?
Thanks.
Thank you very much. That completes the list of folks who had signed up to testify. Are there others who would like to be heard on House Bill 3037? Seeing none, we've already heard that there are some amendments forthcoming. Appreciate the work of the groups and look forward to seeing the results. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3037 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2940. Representative Edwards, you're hiding back there, but please come forward. Barbara, you can give us a summary as we get started.
HB 2940 allows a biomass electricity generating facility to comply with the renewable portfolio standard under certain conditions.
Thank you. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state representative in House District 14, representing West Eugene, Santa Clara, Junction City, Cheshire, and El Vador. I understand that it is the afternoon of a nice sunny day. Some of you look a little bit sleepy post-lunch. I was thinking that perhaps the chair might entertain a motion for an open mic performance by the representative from the Oregon's Christmas Tree District to help liven things up.
Depends on what he's performing, I think.
Friendly amendment. Can we just send him for coffee?
Yeah. I'd go for coffee.
I think that could work, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing my bill, House Bill 2940. And before I launch into the total body of my testimony, I'd like to be clear that that, in fact, there is a pending biomass energy project in my district, but this bill, and that project can move forward with or without this bill, and passage of this bill will neither prevent or enable that. But I'd like to start by providing some context. All of you know that there are a lot of people on this earth. As of this morning, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, it's 6.77 billion. That population is growing at a rate of 220,000 worldwide daily. And by 2050, projections are to be at a world population of 9.4 billion. Every one of those people require resources for their sustenance. The challenge we face as policymakers is how to meet the needs of those people with a finite amount of resources. As we nobly strive, as we should, to raise folks out of poverty, both at home and abroad, we must, I believe, come to terms with the fact that everything we need for our sustenance, even in a knowledge economy, comes from the land, the air, the water, or a combination of the three. We take our natural resources, we apply human sweat and ingenuity to produce the goods and services that we need for our lives. There is no other way, literally. There is no other way. Everything comes by way of human hand from the land, the air, or the water. And with so much of our world living in abject poverty, both at home and especially abroad in less developed nations, where population is especially burgeoning, it is incumbent on us to find sustainable ways to use our resources. Growing and harvesting trees on an industrial scale in accordance with best forestry practices is sustainable and is a part of the answer. While I would argue that drilling holes in the ground either to extract oil, metals, or minerals is certainly less sustainable than growing trees. Now, I think that the policies of this state ought to encourage and incent the sustainable use of our resources, our sustainable resources, especially our sustainable resources like biomass. Yet, we have a policy in this state that says yes to post-1995 biomass energy projects, but no to pre-1995 biomass energy projects. Now, that may have made sense to a lot of folks, yeah, especially political sense, in a much larger debate about the Renewable Portfolio Standards Bill last session. But I would argue that it makes much less policy sense. This bill is an attempt to fix that, what I see as an inequity that resulted last session when that 1995 date, which may have made a lot of sense for hydro projects that provide the bulk of our energy, was imposed on these renewable biomass projects. Biomass projects were caught up in the 1995 date debate and were treated the same as hydro. These biomass projects are owned by companies who are operating in a competitive landscape, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit. To treat post-1995 facilities favorably, in fact, puts the pre-1995 facilities at an economic disadvantage, a competitive disadvantage, for a reason that, quite frankly, is arbitrary as it relates to this policy, the policy on biomass energy projects. I think we should change that. I challenge you to look at it this way. If the pre-1995 facilities, who are competitively disadvantaged, operate at a lower capacity or close, outright close, because their competitiveness is compromised, then we have created a situation where we will be taking biomass, loading it on a truck, and shipping it hundreds of miles, even over mountain passes and such, to take it to a more competitive facility. Now, colleagues, that doesn't make economic sense, and it doesn't make environmental sense either. But it is the reality. If these facilities who face an unlevel playing field, or if that playing field is not leveled, the distribution of many of these, especially the pre-1995 facilities, as you will see in a handout from Oregon Forest Industries Council a little later, is heavily weighted toward rural Oregon, where the biomass resource is. Imagine that. It makes absolutely no environmental sense to put biomass on a truck and haul it longer distances to newer facilities, which may even be located in my district. Many of you know that I grew up in a mill family prior to running for the legislature, and I was the general manager of a small forest products company, our family's company, where we made our living by getting the most out of the resource. We purchased the treetops and pre-commercial thinnings material that was not used by sawmills. We debarked it. We cut it into predetermined lengths that we called blocks, so that it would be used, it would be usable by a stud mill. Then we resold those blocks to stud mills. We chipped the balance, and we sold the bark for biomass energy production. In short, we made a living by getting more value and utility out of the existing resource, which is a sound environmental ethic. I know and I understand personally how these markets work. And it is very low margin work buying a commodity that will then be then adding value and then selling a value-added commodity that will then be used to produce another commodity. It is tough work. The margins are super thin, and like in agriculture, price matters and cost matters. And trucking is one of the most significant costs we faced. And I submit to you that it is not only good economic policy, but good environmental policy to have a wider distribution of these facilities nearer to the sources of the biomass that can feed them. And frankly, it pains me to no end to watch the hand-wringing over how we are going to make our transportation solutions more sustainable, which I support. But then to see folks look the other way or even outright oppose policies that would decrease transportation needs in an industry trying to make the best use of its sustainable resource. Now, at our company, we made a decision to sell our facility because the economic viability of taking a marginal resource and increasing the utilization of that resource and selling into a commodity market did not have a promising future in our particular niche, in our particular geography. It is unfortunate, but the economics just simply weren't there. And because of difficult market conditions for biomass, we had to truck our material to either Riddle or Dillard, south of Roseburg, or all the way down to Medford, White City, just outside of Medford, even over a mountain pass. Several trucks went down loaded and came back unloaded with unnecessary environmental impact, running these trucks hundreds of miles over a pass to move material of marginal value. Colleagues, not only is Oregon timber a part of our heritage, it is a sustainable resource. And I believe that cooler heads have prevailed in the past in treating it as such in many of our state policies. But this, I submit to you, is a glaring inequity that needs fixing if we are to do the right thing by the environment, by the economy, and the right thing by rural communities in Oregon. So I thank you sincerely for hearing this bill, and I look forward to action on it as well.
Thank you, Representative Edwards, for a very comprehensive background. We have about 20 minutes. There are six people who have signed up to testify, so I want to give the committee a chance to ask you questions if there are questions, but I also want to make sure that we use our time most appropriately. So if
sure.
you don't mind taking questions now, even before we get
to
the rest
I'm
of the
happy
folks.
To take questions now, Mr. Chair. I would also submit that some other folks that are going to testify may, and I'm fine taking questions, but they'll have some other data that they're going to share with you that actually may spur more questions.
Of course. Okay. Are there any questions for Representative Rivers at the moment? And if you could stick around, we'd love to have you.
Sure. I'd be happy to.
Great. Okay. So let's proceed to the first panel. Link Cannon, Alan Ford, and Jim Munyana. Hope we've got that right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 2940. With me are some folks who've traveled some distance to speak to you today, so I'm going to be very brief in my comments. I think Representative Edwards did a very good job.
If you could start by identifying yourself.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
Link Cannon, Oregon Forest Industries Council.
Thank you.
Jeez. So I'm not going to talk about this much at all. You do have my written testimony. You do have a chart that Representative Edwards referenced. Mine's all scribbled on, but it shows the facilities in the state that would be affected by this, and I'd be happy to talk about that chart with you at some point, but at this point, if it's okay with everybody else, I'll just defer to the two guests that are here to speak to you. Alan Ford, CEO of Roseburg Forest Products, and Jim Munyan, who's with CoGenCo, a production manager out in Prairie City. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Munyan, and I represent CoGenCo and CoGen2 of D.R. Johnson Companies. I would like to tell you a story. You know, as I listened to Chris promote this House Bill 2940, we live in rural America in a state, Grant County. We have a small cogeneration facility that produces power. It's a passion of mine to see that facilities that are pre-1995 get this new standard. We were the grandfathers of cogenerations. I think in all due fairness that these facilities should be grandfathered in under these bases. We have met every environmental standard that's been put out there for us for, the state requires. There's no reason that I see that these facilities be chastised or kept from it, and I would recommend and support this bill 100% for various reasons. Right now, our facility is currently not operating. We are supplying steam for a sawmill on a short-term basis. Our contract is set to expire in June of 30. June 30th, 2009, and with the hopes to renew that contract in July, but there's no guarantees. As we talked about the forest and the forest restoration and so forth in our state, Prairie City, the CoGen sets in the perfect spot of the Mount Hure National Forest to handle the biomass residuals out there that need to be greatly reduced for various reasons, environmentally wise. I'm thinking fires, jobs. There's so many different variables there that we look at in Eastern Oregon as far as what could and couldn't happen to, based on cogeneration, mills, and so forth. I'm not very versed at talking in front of a group of people such as yourselves, but I do appreciate you listening to me and hearing my convictions. You know, as we think about our state, all right, and the needs that we have, this state is so diverse as far as the timber industry, the fishing, the ranching, and so forth, and I'm just a small portion of it. Biomass, cogeneration, it's all part of it. We all want to make a living, and it's very important that we all do the best that we can to sustain that, and that's what we're here to talk about. Biomass energy and CoGenCo and these facilities that are pre-1995 that pioneered these plants. Anyway, with all that being said, a lot of these new facilities that are coming on board today have actually modeled their facilities after ours, and we just want to be a part of it.
Thank you very much. You did a good job, and it's always helpful to hear stories from folks who are dealing with the issues in a direct way. Thank you very much. Thank Mr. Ford, I'm hoping we can conclude your panel in about 5 minutes, so I give the same time to the next panel, too. So
I'll try to get through this quickly.
Thank you.
My name is Alan Ford. I'm President and CEO of Roseburg Forest Products. Roseburg Forest Products, for maybe you don't know, we're a family-owned integrated wood products manufacturer. That means we make lumber, plywood, particle board, engineered wood products, and we are integrated in the fact we own timberland, and we sell them to the customer. We distribute it nationally. In Oregon, we employ 2,500 people with 7 plants, and we manage and operate on 450,000 acres of timberland. As a company, we have a long history of power generation. Our large facility in Dillard, we have a sawmill, 2 plywood plants, and a particle board plant. And these operations are supported by 3 boilers and 6 turbines. These plants are very, very inefficient. We use the principle of cogeneration. In other words, we generate the high-pressure steam, flash it to the turbines, take the exhaust steam out, and then we dry and do what we have to do with wood. Wood is 50% moisture, and we have to, in most cases, get that moisture out of that wood, so a lot of drying takes place. We have the capacity today to generate approximately 35 megawatts, and we can go up to 45. This is a big plant. That's about 5% of Trojan. And this plant was originally constructed 45 years ago, 1963. We've had some minor changes since that in 1973. Back in the original concept, we used all mill residues. In other words, we used pulp chips, particle board, etc., shavings, ply trim. Today, anything that's wood, we have pulled out of the boiler. We're utilizing that for pulp. We use it for particle board for furniture, fuel pellets, animal bedding. So the only thing we have left as a residual from the original concept is the bark. Today we are actually selling, we have a 5-year contract with Pacific Power to sell 20 megawatts. We started this in 2006. At that time, pre the 2007 bill, that power was considered as green. We use what we call the word green tags and was entitled under the RPS standards. But with the passage of the 2007 bill, because of the 1995 date, when and if we negotiate a new contract, we would be considered in the same classification as natural gas or coal. And I would say that's not a very consistent treatment. At present, with normal operations, 70% of our fuel supply comes from the outside of our operation. We're pulling materials out of bark from other mills, ground up thinnings, demolition waste, and other biomass coming out of landfills. And of course, in going after this waste material, this biomass, we're competing with every other user. Roseburg has been, I think, a real pioneer in developing this concept of sustainable energy. And at present, we are really working hard and looking to what we could feel to be the last big remaining area, which is what we call logging residuals. When we log today, we bring the trees up to the landing, we buck them into logs, and in all this processing, we have a pile of limbs and chunks, etc. And our strategy is to bring this material in, process it, and convert it into biomass to power to generate power. And in western Oregon, that's pretty difficult. Unlike eastern Oregon, we're on steep ground, side slopes, so this gets pretty tricky. There's going to be another treatment that's going to entail a lot of labor, and it's going to entail some specialized equipment. But if we are going to consider maintaining what we have today and in growing, we have to make this investment. We are experimenting. At the time in our present facility, we're looking at the idea of generating additional 10 megawatts to put into the grid. And, of course, all this, we need a stable, consistent fuel supply. The elimination of the 1995 cutoff date is critical for us. To really, when you look at the price of power today, the green premium represents almost 30% of premium, and that is significant. And most of that premium is pushed back to the cost of fuel. So if we're going to compete in the fuel area and if we're going to develop these new systems and these new concepts, we must and have to have that premium to sustain this type of effort. Utilization, and of course I touched base on utilization of the fuel source of the what we're talking about, I think is a wonderful thing for the state of Oregon. I had the privilege of serving on the Governor's Federal Forest Advisory Committee. And some of you that are aware of the summary of that, a very key element is the ability of the state to go out and utilize some of this biomaterial. In the fact, we have a very serious forest health problem taking place in eastern Oregon, and the same thing is starting to occur in southwestern Oregon, and the result is, of course, we get a lot of disease issues, and secondly, we're dealing with catastrophic fire. If you pile on climate change and you deal with the carbon cycle, the importance of dealing with this biomass becomes even more important. Converting biomass to energy is what we call carbon neutral. It's in the same classification as wind power. The advantage of biomass power, though, it is firm. That is, we can burn it, we can utilize it, we can generate it 24 hours, 7 days a week, where wind power effectively is only about 30% of the time. So if we're going to meet our RPS standards as a state, I think biomass is going to play a very, very critical role in meeting that target. Aside from the question of fairness, there's also a logic. The logic itself is flawed. If you look at it, we're motivated to shut down a very efficient facility, go down the road 4 miles, and build a new facility. And effectively, we're doing the same thing. That doesn't make sense. The other question is that in dealing with this fuel, there's only so much fuel to go around to support a given processing center. So these centers are regional. So if we're going to have a consistent application through the state of Oregon, we have to have a consistent ability to tap into the fuel market. And I would also say that these facilities are operating today. We are piloting. We were talking about the paint issue earlier. We are in the process of implementing these new systems. We are acting now. By the time we get these new plants in place and operating, we're probably talking anywhere from 3 to 4 years. So again, I think we're talking about jobs, we're talking employment, and we're also talking about green power. Thank you very much for providing me this opportunity to provide testimony today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Are there questions? No questions. Well, you've done a very good job, Representative Thatcher.
Maybe a comment, and okay. I don't know if it requires, but I really hate it when government decides to insert itself as the picker of winners and losers. In this case, we said the winners are those facilities built after 1995. You lose. And we're just asking to remove that arbitrary barrier. I really support that.
Thank you for the comment. I appreciate the testimony and a good summary of where we are. Really appreciate it. Thank you for coming. We have just a few minutes left for our last panel. Ivan Molesky, Steve Weiss, and Suzanne Lee-DeLue. As you're coming forward, the reason I'm pushing a little bit on the time is we have another bill we need to open up at 2:45, so I'm going to be watching the clock here.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Reed. I'm Suzanne Lee-DeLue, Senior Policy Advocate at Renewable Northwest Project. I know Jeff Bissonette was interested in speaking today, too, so I'm sure I'll share his comments with committee members. I, can speak. I'm happy to answer questions. And actually, Renewable Northwest Project, just so you're aware, we are tracking how utilities are achieving renewable portfolio standards, not just in Oregon, but throughout the region. We have a fact sheet on our website. So if you're interested in learning more about what the resources utilities are using to meet the RPS, we're happy to provide you with more information. Specifically about this particular bill, I think the important thing to recognize is that SB 838, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, was a highly negotiated piece of legislation with many different stakeholders in the room, utilities, both investor-owned and consumer-owned, the Governor's Office, the Public Utility Commission, environmental groups and consumer groups. And when we decided to put this bill together, there's a whole host of components that we agreed to, including the 1995 timeline, and that was primarily because the purpose of the bill, the intent of the bill, was to move forward with new renewable energy generation sources, and that was really the intent. I should also point out that we would strongly discourage the legislature from considering any legislation to alter SB 838 this session. Again, it was a very highly negotiated piece of legislation. The PUC has been working for the past year on rules to implement the Renewable Portfolio Standard. We've been part and parcel of that process, along with the utilities and the customer groups. And we're just now at the point where the PUC is about to finish those rules. They should be complete by the end of the summertime. And I think it's important to let that process play out, let the PUC finish those rules before considering any alterations to SB 838. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ivan Molesky, Conservation Coordinator with the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. Thank you, Chair Reed, and members of the committee for being able to be here today. I guess I would echo some of the comments of the Renewable Northwest Project around the concerns around, at this point, 2 years later, amending Senate Bill 838. That was a highly negotiated and talked about, debated. There were many hearings that took months process. These exact issues were talked about in the last legislature, and it was decided to keep that 1995 cutoff date in there. So, and it is important to remember that this bill, Senate Bill 838, did not prohibit biomass. In fact, it encouraged it, but it would really try to focus on new sources of generation and looking at new, more efficient processes within the biomass sector and kind of really trying to encourage some things. And I have to say, as an organization that has some concerns around biomass, and particularly its use on federal land, and if we're going to use byproducts of old growth or roadless area timber sales, we were not completely comfortable. But again, it was a compromise. Everyone gave a little to come to the table, and I think that I just wanted to flag that there. I think that opening up this can of worms here would not be a good idea for this legislature. I think there are some processes in place to kind of discuss some of these issues, and we should stick with the bill 838 as it was, which again, you know, helps encourage new sources of biomass. We've seen a lot of that develop over the last couple of years, and leave this particular piece as it is. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Weiss.
My name is Stephen Weiss. I'm Senior Policy Associate for the Northwest Energy Coalition. We're a coalition of about 110 different consumer groups, environmental groups, utilities, labor unions, and so on in the Northwest. We oppose this bill as well, and I just want to make a few very quick points. The original RPS, as been mentioned, was to foster new renewable resources, and the this adding in this existing biomass would reduce that standard by about 7%. That is the number of megawatts that the utilities would have to that would come into this program would represent about 7% of the RPS value by 2025. And so it reduces the amount of other new renewables. You could very easily have a line of witnesses coming in saying, gee, by putting this in, you've stopped my project, because it lowers the amount of renewables we have. Secondly, it opens the door for other weakening. There was, during the negotiations, lots of people wanted to count large hydro toward this, and we said, no, this is the large hydro is built, it's not going anywhere, and we don't want to add that in. And so, again, we focus on new renewables. These biomass projects can sell into the voluntary market, the voluntary REC market, so it's not true that that they can get no value from their green qualities. They can still sell to the utilities. The utilities still have a need for power, and they can still sell the power to the utilities. And as we get toward carbon regulation, whether it's a cap and trade or carbon regulation of some sort, These biomass projects, even though they're before 1995, are still considered zero carbon resources. They're not considered coal or gas. It will be considered more like hydro. They will be zero carbon, and so they will have a value in that in a an economy that caps carbon. So these resources are still valuable as green resources, but we have to separate. The reason for an RPS is to spur new renewables and carbon regulation, which deals with emissions. They will be very valuable in controlling carbon, and they'll have that value as we go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. I have to give you a hard time for wearing that shirt here to the Oregon legislature.
I wasn't even planning on coming today. So.
No problem.
Sorry.
No problem. Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. It's obviously an issue that deserves some further discussion, and I imagine we will have an opportunity to do that. So appreciate you being here. And with that, close the public hearing on House Bill 2940 and open public hearing on House Bill 3352. Barbara.
HB 3352 requires the State Department of Energy to develop a model list of home builder installed renewable energy systems, requires an architect providing plans and specifications for residential housing to provide the client with the model list, creates exceptions, requires the developer contracting for construction of residential housing on behalf of or for sale to a specific purchaser to provide the purchaser with the model list.
Thank you, Barbara. Representative Hannah's here. Appreciate being here. Here to hear about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, for the record, Bruce Hanna, State Representative, House District 7. I'm here this afternoon to make a few brief comments on this bill, House Bill 3352. I appreciate you taking the opportunity to hear this bill. It's my intent that the bill be fairly simple. There are a few things that have come up, but I'd like to just outline a few of the things that I believe are important about the bill. Its intent is to provide custom-built home purchasers or builders, buyers, with information on available renewable energy systems. The bill would require the Department of Energy to develop a model list of such systems. Now, there's been much discussion about that, and the bottom line is they basically have a list of renewable energy systems, so there's not much left in terms of them developing that list. Architects and developers would be required to make the list available to those building custom homes, and the home buyer may or may not use the information. So the buyer is under no obligation to install or use the system, but it does give them information available for a custom-built home. Providing the list to the home purchaser does not obligate the developer or architect to install such systems. They just need to make it available. It's my intent that this bill would provide to customers or those building custom-built homes renewable energy systems so that they have options available to them when they are doing that. It's not intended to be an overly burdensome for architects or developers, nor is it intended to be punitive. However, for the bill to move forward, we are working together with the home builders and others to amend the bill to avoid some unintended consequences within it. But the idea here, again, is that when purchasers of custom-built homes get ready to build, that they are provided with all the options available for standard renewable energy systems.
Thank you. Are there questions? I had a couple of questions. Just could you speak a little bit to what the amendments might look like as you're working on those?
We have had a couple of different meetings today. The idea is that once you get into the details of ORS 671010, which applies to some of the architects and and ORS Chapter 701. The Construction Contractors Board would have to, under the way it's written, there's a punitive part to that, and so we would have to amend that to some degree to meet the requirements within this bill. I think it could be done. It came up at the last minute, but we've talked a couple times today, and I think we could get there. I think the builders already are doing a number of things to promote energy efficiency. They have some different levels of energy efficiency they're promoting. Again, this is primarily intended for custom-built homes where you would bring in an architect and or custom home builder, trying to get them to deliver the list. And as I said, the list is pretty much there.
And it looks, as I read it, as though the list and what comprises the list would be left to rulemaking and for the department to decide what's in and out of the list and that sort of thing?
Yeah. There's words like practical, those kind of things. Another point is that the list developed by the Department of Energy should also be approved by the building codes folks, mm-hmm. so that obviously if it was being suggested that it was actually usable within the building codes division. So those are two minor modifications that would get the point across, but would still provide the consumer with the information needed.
Okay. And my last question is, do you have any sense of what the fiscal might be as you're going forward?
Nearly none, in that the Department of Energy already has a number of the renewable energy system lists out there. If you are a very informed home buyer, of course, you can go find all of those things somewhere. It's out there. Again, this is intended to put it in their hand when they're ready to build and let architects and developers add it to custom-built homes.
I appreciate the motivation as a person who has searched for some of those things. It's not always easy to find that information. Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I like the idea behind this bill, but I am kind of wondering, from my standpoint, my experience, it seems like, you know, rather than having the government do this, even if it's minimal, some cost to the government to do this, it seems like industry itself would be better positioned to accomplish that, either through your architect or manufacturers or your home builders as they're soliciting a customer to build something. They have a pretty good knowledge of what systems are out there and what systems they work with, and I don't know, it just seems like this is more of a, to me, it seems like it'd be more efficient to have the private sector bring this information to the customer instead of the government.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I highly agree that the private sector is quite good at that type of work, and they are in consultation with the Department of Energy on this issue. And a perfect example of a tie-in between the two is not last weekend, the weekend before, the Energy Trust Show brought a number of those suppliers and folks together. And again, if you're a very informed home buyer or maybe you lived within driving distance of that show, you got to see all of that. Part of this issue is that there's a fantastic array of products available for custom home building, and as far as that goes, for all home building, but for those buyers who might make a choice to add the option, there's a huge array of those things out there. The Department of Energy is a good source because they also happen to know the tie-ins to tax credits and other vehicles that might incentivize a person who's doing a custom-built home. And again, it's simply to provide the information so that those options are viable and in a person's hand before they get too far down the, you know, construction phase of the project.
Other questions? Representative Foley?
Well, just to follow up, I appreciate that. And, of course, the Department of Energy does have a lot of knowledge on these, you know, but having done some custom homes myself, you know, I've always relied on my designer and architects, you know, and the contractors you use to have a pretty good working knowledge of providing that information. I'm just not convinced the Department of Energy is the correct model for getting this information out there to the public. And I'll think, you know, I'll have more conversations with you about it.
Great. I appreciate that.
Other questions, comments? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your bringing it, and we'll look forward to seeing and talking about your amendments when they come forth. With that, unless there's anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill, House Bill 3352, please come forward. We have just a couple of minutes. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm the Administrator of State Building Codes, and the representative touched on the issue of possibly one agency creating a list and then another agency coming in and say you can't use the product. And I've talked to the Department of Energy and gotten assurance from their staff that as they create the rulemaking, they'll run it through our boards and our experts that we have that kind of set the building codes, because I just don't want to have a situation where there's a list out there, consumer goes to use it, and then one of my or one of the local building inspectors comes along and says you can't do that. I think that would be a bad outcome. So we've made that connection behind the scenes and just wanted to touch on that for the committee.
Appreciate you saying that. It'd be hard to imagine a situation that would promote more cynicism amongst constituents. So
unfortunately, it's actually happened with some of the incentives that are already out there, and I won't go into the details.
Appreciate
to avoid those things.
Appreciate you looking out for it in advance. Thank
all
you
right.
very much. Anyone else who needs to be heard on House Bill 3352? Seeing now, close the public hearing on House Bill 3352 and reopen work session on House Bill 2598 merely for the purpose, colleagues, of carrying it over to our Thursday meeting in the hopes that we might have the fiscal and revenue statement at that time. So close the work session on House Bill 2598. If there's any comments, we did give the notice that we needed for that, I hope. And unless there's any other comment for the order, we're adjourned and we'll see you Thursday.
I think I like that.
Could be. I'm not sure. But
I don't know. Yeah.